Good afternoon, everyone. I want to welcome you to this ITIF debate on the role of surveillance cameras. I'm Rob Atkinson, president of ITIF, and really have a great set of debaters today. This issue obviously was front and center after the tragedy of the bombings in Boston, where video cameras certainly played a role there. So I'm actually just going to turn it over to our moderator, Carrie Johnson. Let me just quickly introduce her. Also, for folks in the audience, we are videotaping this and also live streaming it. Carrie is the justice correspondent for the Washington desk for National Public Radio. She covers a wide variety of stories on justice issues. And prior to coming to NPR in 2010, she worked at the Washington Post for 10 years, where she closely observed the FBI, Justice Department, and related issues. Outside her role at NPR, she moderates panels at legal panels with groups like the ABA, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and others. So we're really honored to have someone who is such an expert on this issue to join us today. So, Carrie?
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you to the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. It's my pleasure to, I should know better with microphones. It's my pleasure to be here today and to introduce our panelists. There's going to be a lively back and forth, but we'll leave 20, 25 minutes at the end of the event for your questions and answers, so be thinking about those now. First of all, I'd like to introduce Daniel Castro, who's a senior analyst at ITIF. He specializes in information technology policy, including health IT, data privacy, e-commerce, e-government, electronic voting, information security, and accessibility. Before joining ITIF, Dan worked as an IT analyst at the Government Accountability Office, where he audited management controls inside the government. He's also worked at Forrester. Did I make that up? No, that was Julian. Sorry. And he's a graduate of Georgetown University and Carnegie Mellon as well. To my far left is Paul Rosenzweig, who's the founder of Red Branch Law and Consulting, a Homeland Security Consulting Company, and senior advisor to the Chertoff Group. Paul formerly served as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Policy in the Department of Homeland Security. He's a distinguished visiting fellow at the Homeland Security Studies and Analysis Institute, and he also has several relationships with local universities and organizations, including George Washington University, National Defense University, and he's a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation as well. To my right is Jay Stanley. He's a senior policy analyst at the American Civil Liberties Union, or the ACLU. Jay works in the Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project, where he researches, writes, and speaks about technology-related privacy and civil liberties issues and the future of all of those issues. He's the editor of the ACLU's Free Future blog and has authored a variety of influential reports on privacy and technology. He also worked at Forrester. I'm sorry. And finally, at the end of the panel is Julian Sanchez. He's a research fellow at the Cato Institute. He studies issues at the very busy intersection of technology, privacy, and civil liberties, with a special focus on national security surveillance. He came to Cato from a career in journalism covering many of these same issues. He was the Washington editor for the technology news site Ars Technica, a blogger for The Economist, and an editor for Reason magazine. So just to give you a short sense of what we're doing, we're going to do some opening statements from each panelist, and then they're going to cross-examine each other, which may be my favorite part of the program. We're going to start first with Mr. Daniel Castro.
Thank you, Carrie. And thanks to my panelists for agreeing to do this debate today. I think it'll be fun. Let me start with a story. Earlier this year in Philadelphia, there was a woman who was waiting for a subway. It was the middle of the afternoon. She was in Chinatown, and there was no one else on the platform except for one man who walked up to her and asked her for the time, and then he grabbed her by the neck, punched her repeatedly in the face, threw her onto the tracks, and then fled, taking her cell phone. Now, there were no other people around, so there were no witnesses. And even if she had been able to identify her attacker, there is likely little evidence that would have tied him to this crime. Fortunately, in this case, the story has a happy ending. For one, she was able to pull herself off the tracks and wasn't seriously injured. But two, there was a public surveillance camera on the subway platform. The police were able to see what happened. They were able to identify her attacker. And within 2 days, they had the man arrested. I wanted to start off with the story because I think most people know that surveillance cameras are very useful in some of the high-profile crime that we've seen, in terrorist attacks, the Oklahoma City bombing, the 2007 London subway bombing, most recently in the Boston Marathon bombing. People understand that surveillance cameras have been very useful in solving these crimes, but what they don't necessarily know is that it's really every week that cities around the world are using cameras to solve crimes, to reduce crimes, and to make police forces more efficient. I want to touch on each of these points. So I think the biggest benefit that we have from public surveillance cameras is really its ability to help police and law enforcement solve crimes or resolve crimes. It helps them understand what happened, figure out the sequence of events that led to a crime, understand details like, was a getaway car used? Were weapons used? If there were weapons used, were they left behind at the scene? Where should they be looking for clues? It allows them to identify suspects, allows them to identify eyewitnesses that they can then find out who else was there, who else they should be talking to. It can help them identify accomplices. And I think very importantly, of course, it also helps clear innocent people, people that might have been accused of doing something, but the evidence clears them. The video evidence is also very useful for getting confessions. This does two things. First of all, it makes the process of law enforcement go faster, and so it's less costly. It's also very useful for if you do end up going to trial, you can actually have more useful evidence. There are often times where an eyewitness is not considered credible, and by either using the video footage as supplementary evidence or as the only evidence, it can be very useful in prosecution. And this, of course, gets to the second point, which is this helps get criminals off the street, right? This is what we really want. So public surveillance cameras can reduce crime in multiple ways. The first way is kind of the most obvious, is that it provides police intelligence about what's going on in the community. It allows them to do the standard policing that goes on. Baltimore launched a very successful Crime Watch program a number of years ago where they deployed hundreds of cameras throughout the community. And one of their early success stories was when they had some police officers who were monitoring the cameras, and they saw a man outside of a convenience store stop and put on a ski mask. Well, that was anomalous behavior, so they sent a police officer over there, and they were able to stop a robbery that was in progress. Since then, this has happened again and again. In 2010, the Baltimore police reported that they had over 1,200 camera-initiated or camera-assisted arrests, and those numbers have been more or less the same. Urban Institute did a study in Baltimore of the effectiveness of the program, and they found significant declines in total crime, in violent crime, and in larceny, and they were looking over a five-year period. But even the camera's mere presence can help deter crime in a number of ways. First, criminologists kind of talk about the crime triangle. So you have three things that you need to have a crime. You need opportunity, you need location, and you need victim. And the public surveillance cameras get to especially opportunity and location. So criminals want to avoid being caught. They want to avoid being publicly shamed if they are caught by having their deeds caught on camera. It also helps people feel safe. You know, if you're walking down the street, you feel better if there is a police officer there. What this means is that in some high crime areas, people naturally avoid these areas. That encourages more crime because there's no witnesses, there's no one around. What we found is with public surveillance cameras, that can encourage people to go back out into the community, and it can reduce crime through that way as well. And finally, just the presence of a camera reminds people that there is crime in the world, that they should be vigilant, that they should lock their door, they should be aware of their surroundings, and this is important too. There have been many implementations of public surveillance cameras that have been implemented in different cities. And the evidence, there have been lots of evaluations of these implementations. What I think is interesting is in 2008, there was a meta-analysis done of basically 10 to 15 years worth of programs that had been done. And they found that overall, on average, the reduction in crime in cities was about 7% from the use of public surveillance cameras. And the impact was even significantly stronger in certain types of deployment. So if you look at things like using public surveillance cameras for transit, using it in parking lots, this was much higher, it was about 25% and 50% respectively. And as I said, this was over a long period of time. Many of these studies are from the 90s, and we've actually seen improvement in the effectiveness of the deployments over time because naturally different departments have learned how to deploy these better. The third real benefit is that public surveillance cameras help make policing more efficient. Using cameras is basically letting police do what they were doing before but do it better. It's considered a force multiplier. It's a technology that allows one police officer to monitor multiple locations at the same time. This is a cost savings because police forces can reduce their labor cost. And then you can either reallocate these resources somewhere else, or you can return the money saved to the taxpayers. The Urban Institute did a study in Chicago on the effectiveness of the public surveillance cameras that were implemented there. They found that for every dollar spent on the camera systems to operate and maintain them and to deploy them, the city saved almost $3. So they saved $3 for every dollar spent. Significant savings there. I would just mention that the other kind of benefit to police forces is that it does help prevent abuses. It helps hold police accountable, just as it holds citizens accountable for their behavior. So I just want to end by talking about how the technology has changed, because I think it's important to remember that the technology has continued to improve over time, and as the technology improves, we'll likely see continued improvement in the types of outcomes here. One change that we've seen is a move from analog tapes to digital video recorders. This has cut the cost of deployments down. We've seen better cameras that have better resolution, that have better visibility at night, that can provide better coverage. This makes them more useful in investigations. This makes them more useful for prosecuting criminals. We have network cameras. This allows for centralized viewing. This allows for centralized storage, and again, it cuts down the cost. We have digital video search capabilities. This makes it much faster to find the footage that you need. And this is one of the high labor costs involved when you want to find something. We have better video analytics, so you can actually log anonymous behavior automatically. We can also integrate video cameras with other types of technology that are being deployed in the communities, such as gunshot locator systems. So what this means is if a shot is fired in the city, you can use the cameras to provide real-time intelligence to first responders before they get there. That keeps them safer and allows them to respond more effectively. And finally, we can also use wireless networks that are now prevalent. This allows faster redeployment in changing conditions. So just kind of in summary, I think the point is, whether you're interested in reducing crime, saving lives, or saving taxpayer money, it just makes sense to be using public surveillance technology.
Thanks, Dan. We're going to head now to Jay Stanley of the ACLU, who I think may have some counterpoints to your presentation.
I might.
No, you can't. There are none.
Thank you very much, and thanks for inviting me to participate in this debate. I think what this debate about is not whether a camera can ever do good and whether any camera anywhere ever does good. I mean, first of all, we don't disagree with that, and second of all, that horse has left the barn. In any case, we do have cameras throughout our society to a certain degree. The way I view it, the real public policy debates before Americans now is, number one, do we want to allow ourselves to drift towards pervasive mass surveillance using surveillance cameras? And number two, should our public policy, should our government be pushing us in that direction with hundreds of millions of dollars in funds and so forth, which is what's happening? So I guess I want to make just three basic points here. Number one, the benefits of the cameras are exaggerated. Number two, the dangers of conferring the considerable powers upon the government that cameras, consist of are significant. And number three, the potential for chilling effects here and deep effects on our public life is very real. Cameras, so the first point, the benefits being exaggerated. Clearly, cameras don't stop terrorist attacks. They didn't stop Boston, they didn't stop the Times Square attempted car bombing, they didn't stop London, Madrid. Clearly, they can have forensic value after the fact, and clearly that can be valuable in, for example, stopping somebody from carrying out a second attack. But that said, it's not a silver bullet that people often imagine it to be. In the Times Square example, for example, there were 82 cameras in Times Square, and none of them were helpful in identifying the perpetrator. The way he was identified was through old-fashioned law enforcement work. The kind of law enforcement work that doesn't, produce video that shows up on television. Despite that, in fact, the video leads that they had actually sent the police down several wrong trails, some wild goose chases, and caused innocent people to be interrogated by the police. Despite that, the NYPD went ahead with plans to invest $110 million in surveillance cameras in midtown Manhattan. We see that DHS has put hundreds of millions of dollars, I think $300 million at one point was the figure that I saw, in grants to localities for surveillance cameras. So we're talking about very large sums of money, and the question is what are the benefits we're getting for that? There's an opportunity cost. That money could be spent on other law enforcement techniques, such as community policing, which may be more effective. And the question is, what's the what do cameras get us, but what is the marginal improvement in safety and security that we get from these cameras, aside from the fact that we already have cameras in most high-profile spots, which we basically have never opposed. I mean, going back to 2002, we've always said we don't have a problem with cameras at, the Statue of Liberty or places like that. The places that tend to be high-value terrorist targets also tend to be swarming with personal video, people's own videos. So what you're, for all these hundreds of millions of dollars, we're getting cases where, in terms of terrorism, where the personal video, the existing video don't do anything, and yet these additional video cameras do. I think that that's just an outline. And then, of course, there's the whole question about getting away from terrorism to routine crime, and it's actually surprising how difficult criminologists have found it to find strong effects on crime. There have been studies all over the map, but the overall picture is quite muddy. So my second point, the dangers of conferring the power of surveillance cameras are significant. There are the well-known sort of dangers of voyeurism, of ethnic targeting, which studies found in Britain took place very frequently. There's the potential for abuse. We've seen police officers use police databases for stalking former spouses and their new boyfriends and people they got in traffic altercations with and so forth. There are plenty of examples of that. There's the New York City police helicopter, which was supposedly watching a protest and swung its camera over and videotaped using night vision a couple making love on a dark balcony rooftop who had no idea that anybody could see them and kept the camera trained on there for 20, 30 minutes. And then when that, the only reason we know about that is because the footage happened to come out in the course of litigation over the protest. And when it came out, the NYPD was completely unapologetic about it, said they were doing their job. And of course, aside from these sort of abuses by, you could call them police bad apples, there's the larger context of abuse. The fact that, in the Cold War, we saw COINTELPRO, where there was a mass pattern of police abuse and surveillance for political purposes. I'm just going to read a little excerpt from a conclusion by the Church Committee, which investigated it. The government has swept in vast amounts of information about the personal lives of American citizens. This has continued for decades, despite the fact that these groups did not engage in unlawful activity. Groups and individuals have been harassed and disrupted because of their political views and their lifestyles. Unsavory and vicious tactics have been employed, including anonymous attempts to break up marriages, disrupt meetings, ostracize persons from their professions, and provoke target groups into rivalries that might result in deaths. Now, you could say that's ancient history, but I would argue that these kind of patterns, first of all, they extended for decades before the decade in which COINTELPRO came out, going back to the teens and 20s, at least. And second of all, the sort of political targeting continues to today. We see the Talon database, which kept surveillance on anti-military protesters and peace protesters. We see urban police intelligence units being recreated, the monitoring and infiltration of Occupy protesters, the targeting of Arabs and Muslims, the routine and intentional and foreplanned suppression and invasion of constitutional speech rights at the political conventions and other large gatherings as a conscious strategy. This enormous power that we're conferring by creating a network of pervasive video cameras is taking place in a context where we need to be very, very careful about giving that kind of power to the government. The government, security agencies are bureaucracies as well, and there's sort of a mindless character to bureaucracies that will inevitably push the use of surveillance cameras deeper into our lives. I think this was highlighted by a New York Times article a couple of weeks ago about the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, which showed up at the U.S. Championship for ice fishing, in which individuals sat around in ice trying to catch the biggest fish, and they gave them drug tests. And this is a perfect example of how a mindless bureaucracy, pushes its power beyond any kind of common sense or reason. And it was quite a funny article. so that's the second point. My third point is that the chilling effects are very real. I mean, this is a subtle argument, and it's very abstract compared to sort of some of the common sense, you know, anecdotes. But I think that it's nonetheless very real. I mean, we're really entering a new period, a radical experiment, if you will, in human history, where we start to videotape everything that everybody does once they step outside of their homes or other private spaces. It's never been done before, and we don't, you know, we don't really have experience with that. There's a rich body of social science research that shows that people alter their behavior, adhere more strictly to social norms, and feel more compelled to follow rules very strictly when they're being watched, when they perceive they're being watched. They experience public self-awareness. And that obviously can be a good thing if you have a particular situation where there's a lot of crime or what have you. But how far do we want to push that exactly? Daniel mentioned, you know, searching for anomalous behavior. Do we really want anybody who exhibits anomalous behavior in public to find themselves being interrogated by a police officer? Aside from the chilling effects on political behavior, that could convey a certain conformism and stultedness and formality in American life. If you go to some certain Scandinavian countries, they will stand, if it says don't walk, on a very small road at 3 in the morning when there isn't a car for 2 miles away, and they will stand and they won't cross it. Americans have always been a more freewheeling people. And I think that that's a good thing. That's something that's a healthy thing in American culture. And how far do we want to go in allowing our sort of the suppression of that? So I'm going to just make one final point, which is that I think that and it's actually goes back to what I said about the effectiveness in some ways, but and that is, I think that our perception, you know, as we make the judgments, the costs versus the benefits here, all of our perceptions are somewhat warped. And they are warped because the thing about video cameras is they create video. And video gets on television. And television is how we judge things. So when the investigators investigating the Times Square bombing, you know, found the VIN number on the bottom of the engine block and used that to investigate the automobile and who it was purchased from and started interviewing the woman who sold it to him and so forth, that didn't create video. That didn't show up in the nightly news. Whenever you have a crime that is solved by video, the video shows up on the nightly news. The video is used in television crime dramas because video produces video. And so I think that there is a distorting effect in how we make these judgments. So, you know, I have much more to talk about. There's so many things I could say about all these videos, so I don't take up too more of my time.
We turn now to Paul Rosenzweig, who perhaps has some thoughts about the mindless bureaucracy and the stultification of American behavior.
I believe in the mindless bureaucracy, having been a part of it. First, I want to begin by welcoming Jay to the group of us who oppose the Europeanization of America. And I'm sure that you will soon join us against the socialist policies and all that sort of stuff, right? You're going to join the right wing. That having been said, I begin agreeing to some degree with Jay that the question really is one of cost-benefit analysis, and that this is actually an empirical question. I think that when you take that perspective, the first thing you have to do is realize that there's a fundamental contradiction in the viewpoint of opponents of surveillance cameras, which is a reflection, to be fair, about a fundamental contradiction on the other side, of my side, but I think it's more prominent on that side, which is as follows. The premise is that pervasive surveillance stultifies or changes human behavior if it's good human behavior of the sort that Jay would want to foster, but that it does not, or that there is no evidence that it actually deters adverse criminal behavior. So in other words, we want to say that the panopticon effect only works in one direction against positive risk-taking by the American public in crossing the streets, but not in terms of deterring criminal behavior. That seems to me is a fundamental premise that we ought to accept, that cameras do indeed change behavior, and they change criminal behavior, and they also change non-criminal behavior. The question is whether or not we want to accept that. Now, there are a couple of ways you could think about that. I think the way I start is by realizing that no human endeavor of any sort is perfect in practice, right? And that there are only two answers to that fundamental conundrum. The first one is to prohibit the practice because you think that the error rate is too great and that you cannot abide the false positives. Or if you think that the benefits are worth the candle, you put into place oversight and surveillance and audit systems of one form or another in order to try and minimize the negative consequences while maximizing the benefits. Now, historically, that's the course we've taken with respect to government power and policing. We give every cop guns. It's a pervasive thing. Every police officer in America is armed. And we do this notwithstanding the fact that we are absolutely certain, as we do that, that some fraction of those police officers will misuse their weapons, either by accident or on purpose. Some will shoot the wrong person accidentally. Some will engage in racist behavior and shoot somebody out of an improper motive, or they'll shoot their wife's lover or something like that. But we don't outlaw the guns, right? We don't have a system that says the risk of that failure methodology is too great. Instead, we do all sorts of what are admittedly kludgy things, training, hiring, auditing, internal affairs divisions, administrative processes, criminal processes in the end, because we, in the end, believe that the advantages to society of having an armed police force in stopping and deterring crime more generally are well worth the disbenefits that arise from the infrequent police misactions that we know will occur. So how does that play out in the surveillance camera space? I tried to do a little research. It's remarkably hard to get a fixed number of how many property crimes there are in America in a given year. The databases aren't very good. You know, the FBI has some. So the best number I found was roughly 30 million. Such incidents across the nation annually. And those range, right? You know, I couldn't get any differentiation. But if we accept the meta-analysis of 7% reduction and we limit it to property crimes where surveillance cameras are said to have been more effective than in the reduction of violent crimes, that's 2.1 million property crimes that don't happen, roughly, every year by virtue of having surveillance cameras in place. Now, I can't tell you how much money was saved from that because you can't put a value on each one of those ones. But that's an awful lot of criminal behavior that isn't occurring or seems to be being deterred by the existence of cameras. Now, balanced against that is what I would call real but theoretical problems about changes in culture that I think can be minimized in a whole host of ways, and I'll talk about that in just a second, and real but pretty infrequent by anybody's standards, instances of actual police abuse. I mean, the frequency with which we know that this is happening is relatively small. I'm sure, as Jay would say, that there are instances that we're unaware of and we don't know what we don't know, so I would concede that. But we haven't seen a wellspring of reports of police abuse, and we haven't seen that notwithstanding the fact that today, unlike in the COINTELPRO era, we have lots of really great organizations like Cato and the ACLU who are spending their time trying very hard to protect us all from that sort of abuse. Indeed, I kind of join Michael Kinsley in the view that I love the ACLU. They are the canary in the mine shaft, and their job is to protect me. That's why I actually give to Cato, not to the ACLU. Sorry, Jay. But I am a donor to Cato for that very reason. So how would we want to go about structuring an oversight and audit policy that would give us the benefit of surveillance cameras without the disbenefit of police abuse? I think we have a good model here in the District of Columbia. It's not ideal, but there are pervasive surveillance cameras, government-owned and operated surveillance cameras around D.C. Some of them are not on all the time, right? They're only turned on when large-scale events are happening within the district. Protests on the Mall, the annual World Bank meeting where there's some fear that some of the protesters might engage in violent behavior, that sort of thing, right? And there's a limited retention time, right? If nothing has happened, the data from those surveillance cameras is destroyed after a short period of time. And there's an internal audit process that's managed by the D.C. Council that ensures, to the extent you can ensure anything, the police compliance with these sorts of rules. And indeed, on the one instance in recent memory in which they seem to have violated the strictures that were imposed upon them, the D.C. Council had a hearing, yelled at them. And the behavior was, it seems, corrected. Is this a perfect system? No. There's no such thing as a perfect system for controlling human behavior, at least not in my judgment and in my experience. But what it is a reasonably effective system of audit, oversight, and control that in the end allows us to get as much of the benefit as we can out of surveillance cameras. That is, the knowledge that they're there and available in this instance, times when it is likely that we think that there's more likely to be the need. I would make one final point, or two final points. I will take the opportunity to prebut Julian, who has written about the virtues of using private cameras, private surveillance cameras, as a replacement for government-owned surveillance cameras. And I would agree with him that that's a wonderful supplement to government surveillance, and I think that's to be commended. I would suggest, however, that in the end, it's a fundamental misconception that public security is a public good for a reason, right? That we provide a uniform police force across the city precisely because we don't want to have it, the security of a police force distributed unevenly on the basis of class and ability to pay. And if we rely on private security cameras and only private security cameras for their criminal deterrence effects, the natural consequence of that will be prevalence of private security cameras with whatever deterrent effect they have in areas where more well-to-do engage in commerce, and much less frequently in the poorest neighborhoods in this city or in this country that are the most likely to be in need of that kind of deterrent effect in many instances, since that's where much of the prevalence of crime is. And the final point I would make, which would be to almost echo something that Daniel ended with, is you can't sweep back the tide, right? I saw the other day a new product called Mimoto, which is going to be a half-inch square wearable camera, video camera, that will be taking pictures and not wiping them after 30 days, but uploading to the cloud for permanent storage. And Google Glass, you know, is going to have live video on your face. So that's obviously not government surveillance, but whether you like it or not, the technology of more pervasive surveillance is coming. So to my mind, the question is not whether or not we can, like King Canute, try and sweep back the tide of technological change, but whether or not we're going to get inside the radius of the technology curve and try and begin the process of thinking about the right ways to limit, restrict, audit, and oversee the deployment of these tools so that we can get as much of the benefit as we can with as little of the disbenefit, as little of the cost as we can manage. And I'll end there.
Okay, we turn now to Julian Sanchez, who's going to be the cleanup hitter, and I know he's not going to go light on Paul just because Paul is donating money to the Cato Institute.
You better be.
This is an impressive judo flip, actually. Thank God we have Cato and the ACLU, so it's safe to have a surveillance state.
Indeed.
So I actually want to begin where Paul left off, because I do think it's important to stress that this is a debate about really public and citywide networked surveillance systems, the kind we've seen in London, most famously, but also Chicago, New York, Baltimore. And that's important because, as Jay stressed, this really is an argument where the question is one of marginal benefit, not can you find an anecdote where a camera was useful for something. Anything you devote law enforcement resources to that isn't, you know, completely frivolous, after the fact you will find some instances in which it was useful for some purpose. That is not, right, the correct analytic standard when there's a range of different things you can be devoting those resources to, and the question is, what gives you the most bang for your buck? And I think precisely because, as Paul suggests, surveillance technology is becoming cheaper and is more widely distributed in private hands, extraordinarily costly and in some ways perilous to civil liberties, publicly sponsored systems make less sense the more non-public surveillance we already have. We saw, of course, in Boston that Lord & Taylor camera ended up being the one that was useful for identifying the perpetrators there. within a week after that, the police in my neighborhood actually were canvassing after a mugging, basically asking for private surveillance video that might have been useful. So the question is, if private entities are already increasingly deploying their own camera systems, the first steps in estimates in the first decade after 9/11, there were 30 million surveillance cameras purchased and added to the streets and active, and only a tiny fraction of those are public government-run ones. We can get, if the real benefit of these cameras is not the sort of fantasy of aberrant behavior detection, preemptive, kind of rapid intervention, it will happen occasionally, but it is rare, as opposed to after the fact, sort of forensic utility, should we be spending money? Another thing the urban study found is that invariably these systems are far more expensive to maintain and operate over time than they're initially estimated to be. Can we get that benefit without having the public bear those costs and without the potential risks to civil liberties that are entailed? And I want to suggest that there is a significant difference between dispersed centers of surveillance that are individually localized, that is to say the relative sort of risk to civil liberties of non-networked, individually operated cameras that are capturing a delimited area and usually wiping the footage every few days, as opposed to a kind of centralized, centrally monitored system where it's at your discretion how long material is kept, but also where, as face recognition technologies improve, we see the potential for tracking of individuals across long periods of time across an entire city, which is the kind of surveillance that in United States v. Jones, Justice Alito's concurrence suggested could implicate the Fourth Amendment rights, even when that kind of monitoring is done in a public place. As that technology becomes cheaper, becomes more pervasive, and certainly as people begin, in fact, wearing cameras, the marginal benefit of having a camera on a lamppost is going to start seeming implausible to be more effective than other things the government is in a unique position to do, like provide public lighting, gunshot detection systems, the kind that Dan mentioned, other things that private entities aren't doing, and that also, incidentally, nobody thinks pose any serious risk to civil liberties. The one place you do see kind of plausible real benefits from the publicly operated cameras are that precisely in places where, in essence, a private owner of a piece of property would also almost certainly have their own cameras, but because the government is the owner, they're sort of the only one that can have the cameras. So we're talking here about enclosed parking lots and transit systems like subway platforms that are operated by the government, so anyone's going to have a camera there. The government sort of has to operate it. I don't know about Jay. I basically have no problem with that. If you have subway platforms where there's crime fleet at night, then sure, it may well make sense to, in those specific places, have cameras. They may be effective there because those are places criminals specifically sort of seek out because they're places where people are alone late at night and the crime is really in a way geared to that location. But that's not, I think, something that supports the case for these broader citywide networks, especially because to the extent you see positive results in the empirical work that's done, it does tend to be so highly concentrated in areas like that. The urban study that they mentioned is one, I think, something of an outlier. I mean, it found positive results in Baltimore and Chicago, not really in D.C., but even in the places where it found benefits, they were highly sort of erratic. Some neighborhoods had large benefits, some had very little at all. And research has been done, commissioned by the Home Office in the UK, that's sort of the longest running case study, but also in Los Angeles, in San Francisco, in New York, have had a lot of trouble finding a visible benefit. So given that the costs, even just in monetary terms, are obviously quite substantial, it's just dangerous to be misled by concentrated benefits of a very specific kind into thinking that in general we've proven the efficacy of citywide camera networks. I don't think that's been proven at all. Again, the question we should be asking is not does a camera ever create a benefit, it's given all the things you can be doing many of which are cheaper, many of which have a civil liberties downside. Why is this? Why are we first moving to the solution that does sort of have these civil liberties concerns? I wonder whether it isn't because we've gotten so accustomed to talking about trade-offs between privacy and security that we almost just don't feel secure. We don't feel like a solution can be very effective if it doesn't in some way give us a creepy feeling or make us feel like our privacy diminishes. Other solutions that don't have that downside feel like an all creme brulee diet. It just seems like, unless there's some pain involved, we can't really be getting the benefit. And just the final point I'd make is that we should be thinking not just in terms of localized benefits or potential for abuse of the kind of small bore kind, the cops looking in your window, bad though that would be. I think we should be thinking in terms of what Bruchschneier calls civic hygiene, which is to say, don't just think about whether you are solving a near-term security problem, but whether you are creating a long-term architecture that you would be uncomfortable seeing fall into the hands of an authoritarian regime of the kind we certainly hope will not rise to power, but it is not an impossible occurrence, certainly in the wake of the kind of terrorist attacks that prompts calls for this kind of surveillance architecture. Is it an architecture you are willing to risk being available to that kind of regime should it ever arise? And I think that is something that weighs very heavily in the downside of these public networked centralized systems when we have so many other ways to get the same benefits without creating those risks.
Thank you. If I could just control my mic, sorry. So now we're going to begin my favorite part of this program. We're going to do two cross-examination periods in which first, Jay is going to cross-examine Daniel about his position. And then next, we're going to turn to Paul, who's going to cross-examine Julian. I do not have a whistle. I am wearing black and white. I will be a little bit generous if you're in the middle of making a point. But we're going to keep this to about 15 minutes. And for starters, Jay.
Okay, thank you. My first question is, does it worry you at all to think about the advanced analytics that can be attached to cameras? The fact that, one of the things that you said was that, that cameras can act as a multiplier effect for police force because a single officer can monitor multiple areas. I think that one of the problem with that is that studies have shown that people sort of watching video screens is completely ineffective because they get bored after about 12 minutes and stop watching them, which is why video cameras are not really very effective for sort of real-time monitoring. But of course, the solution to that is analytics, or the solution that's being sold and proposed. So we have cameras with analytics being put on them, with extremely powerful zoom lenses, pan, tilt, and zoom capability, night vision, face recognition, which is a form of analytics, and behavior detection. Are you fine with all of that being put on every camera so that it can zoom in on your every pimple and track you around, identify your face, find out that you are you, know exactly where you are, when, and so forth? Do you have any hesitation about that?
Yeah, so I think, I would say in general, no. I mean, what we're looking at is police using technology to be more efficient, right? So when you bring up analytics, I mean, to me, that says, that actually talks to substantial progress that we've seen in criminology, where police forces now use things like city stats to really do targeted policing, data-driven policing, and that's shown to be much more effective. That's what we want. We want our police forces to put their resources where they can be effective. And so, whether it's using analytics from video or using analytics from, crime maps with little pins put in the map, which is what they did in the past, or using other types of reports, I think that's exactly what we want. Now, you talked about a few other things. You talked about, police, getting bored. I think police get bored anyway going out there. What you're seeing is that they actually they're able to do more. you know, they're able to monitor multiple locations. They're able to put their resources and their attention on high crime areas. So, you know, as Paul mentioned earlier, I mean, with DC, where they're sometimes turning on certain cameras, you can do that if you know that there, you know, this is a street corner where we've seen a lot of crime in the past few weeks, and we want to put attention there. We can use, you know, the pan, tilt, zoom cameras. I think, you know, people think that this is kind of some fancy technology. That's a pan, tilt, zoom camera right up there that we're webcasting with. It's a normal camera. It allows you to actually see what you want to see. I think that's a good thing. I mean, to say that we would want to use cameras that you couldn't see what you want to see would just not make any sense. Facial recognition, I think, is something that's a long ways off. Certainly, you know, if we're talking about facial recognition to identify suspects. So if we're trying to identify, you know, who's this person and we're doing some kind of targeted surveillance, I think that makes sense. That's what police officers are doing anyway. This is helping with that process. So overall, no, I think all of these technologies are getting us to be more efficient.
So if the cameras, if there's a network of cameras, they all have face recognition, they all log your location and time, and that system exists in a density such that basically the police later on could carry out retroactive surveillance of you or anybody. Not just you, but people, you know, people maybe who are, you know, political activists on one side of the spectrum or the other, and basically anybody, and can find out, you know, every place you've been, every doctor you've visited, what their specialty is, and what houses of worship you go to, and what political organizations you go to, and what sexually oriented establishments you might visit, and who your friends are, and you know, I mean, don't you think that's a problem? I mean, don't you think that's too much power to give to the government?
Well, first of all, I think if you wanted to do that type of surveillance, you wouldn't do it through video. You'd do it through something else. You could, you know, right now with your cell phone, you can track where people are going, and that's a much more pervasive form of surveillance if you wanted to do the kind of location-based surveillance that we're going to have. The question you're really asking is, you know, do we want to have controls on abuses of this technology? And yes, we do want to have controls. And in fact, most of the deployments always come with a set of guidelines by which these camera systems are going to be operated. There have been, you know, best practices put out, and these are continually being developed as the technology changes. We shouldn't say that because, you know, future technology might be abused, we can't make any progress with using better technology.
Would you have a problem with the government installing a camera in everybody's bedroom and the video footage not being watched by anybody because there's lots of controls on them? So that the camera is only watched if there's suspicion that maybe, for example, as in the Cleveland case, you know, you're harboring a kidnap victim, or that you're plotting a bomb, you know, building a pressure cooker in your bedroom. I mean, the police could definitely solve crimes with that kind of system. And if we had the proper controls in place, then none of the rest of us need worry. Would you be comfortable with that? And if not, why not?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, no. I mean, the difference is that we're talking about public surveillance cameras. We're talking about cameras that are being deployed in the public space where they're seeing things that police officers are seeing already. They're allowing police officers to do what they were doing before more efficiently.
I think that gets to an important difference between our positions, which is the question of whether we, in fact, have any privacy in public. And I think that, you know, that we would say there are important dimensions in which we do have privacy, even though we are in public. For example, as you go about your day, you may be under the visual surveillance of those who are within visual range of you, but the monitoring that takes place of you is fragmented, and that the fragmentation of the surveillance of you is an important privacy protection, whereas if somebody has a bird's eye view of you as you travel throughout your day, that's an important dimension of privacy that one is losing. So I think, you know, that's one point. And then I guess another question would be, would you have any problem with audio, if all the cameras had audio on them?
So, you know, to your first point, you know, the kind of pervasive surveillance, I think it's important to, you know, note very clearly that that's not what we're talking about right now. I mean, we're talking about using publicly, you know, using cameras to video record in public in ways that are not, you know, creating this kind of massive database of everyone's location. So I just want to be clear, when we're, you know, what we're talking about right now is not that. And what people have been objecting to routinely over the past 10 years has not been this other thing. It's been even just putting a camera out there on the street corner to watch someone committing a crime. So I just want to make sure we're perfectly clear on that. To your second question about audio, I mean, there are a number of laws that prevent audio recording. along with video in public.
You support those laws?
Yes, in general, yes. I think I came from Texas where you were allowed to do some of it. And so I grew up knowing that it could be recorded. But I think in general, when you're in public, there are some expectations. That said, right now I can walk around with an audio recorder. We have one right here. It's tiny. I could have it in my shirt, and I could record lots of conversations, even in private places. Now, if I did something that was abusive with that, you would have the right to take action in many states. And I think, those are the kinds of conversations we can have about, how do you respect people's privacy, where do you draw lines, but that's very different than saying, do we want to have a camera on the street corner where we have lots of crime?
So you think that you have a problem with pervasive audio surveillance but not pervasive video surveillance?
Yes, because I think there's a difference in expectation. When I'm walking down the street, I don't hear conversations around me unless I'm very close. I think it's different with video because you are seeing the same, you are seeing things around you.
I think that, but what you're talking about is the different levels of privacy that we have in public. I think that the ability to walk down the street with another person and have an intimate conversation because you can visually see that nobody is near you is an important privacy element of privacy that we have even though we're in public. And I'll note that it's being challenged because buses and other places want to put audio recording on. But I think that the ability to walk around throughout one's day without leaving a trail in video databases is another important privacy thing. But so have you compared the effectiveness of cameras as anti-crime tool? Well, two questions. Number one, are you mainly interested in the ability of cameras as it seems as though you're not really focused on terrorism, but on sort of everyday crimes. And number two, in terms of the everyday crimes, have you compared their effectiveness to other methods for reducing crime? I mean, are there studies that show that, the comparative studies that show research that the cameras are actually better dollar for dollar than other, crime?
Yeah, so I mean, I think when you look at surveillance cameras, you want to look, what are the net benefits, what are the net costs? That's how you should look at it. So some of it will be terrorism, most of it will be...
But I'm talking about something else different, which is not just the net benefits and costs of the cameras, but the comparative costs, the opportunity costs for how they compare to other ways of spending the money that one could spend it on, such as putting more actual police officers who can actually stop a crime from happening instead of just recording it.
Right, so virtually every implementation of surveillance cameras has not been done where people just stick cameras out there and hope something good happens. There's always changes that go along with this. So, there's changes in policement enforcement strategies, there's changes in community engagement. So, and this is one of the problems with evaluations of these programs. And this is a problem just, in general with any kind of public policy study. It's a little messy, right? So when you look at these studies, you do see that there are net positive benefits in many implementations. In some cases, you're seeing that they're more than paying for themselves. So when you're talking about, is it better than something else? Well, if at the end of implementing this, you actually have more, a larger budget, then it doesn't really matter because you can still put additional resources somewhere else. You haven't cost the city anything.
Okay, last question on this side. We're going to start round two. Paul is going to cross-examine Julian for 7 to 8 minutes. Action.
I've been waiting for this one, Julian. Now, a few kind of set of questions. Just I want to make sure that we have a baseline for the discussion. You questioned the studies about effectiveness. I assume that we are in agreement that all of the studies that we're aware of are either neutral and ambiguous or positive. That is to say, I'm not aware of any study that says that the use of public surveillance cameras has a negative effect.
I may have seen one or two, but those are certainly outliers, yes.
Okay, so we're starting at here and maybe moving up, right? Okay.
Although, of course, I mean, if these are systems that cost...
We'll get the cost in a second. I'm just looking. Yeah, you better put that closer to you. So I just want to make sure. And I assume we're also in agreement that, at least anecdotally, right, cameras are useful in some instances for solving crimes that would otherwise not have been solvable.
The counterfactual is typically difficult to ascertain, right? I mean, so you always will have a story that, sort of everything is in the last place you look. Because mm-hmm. when you find it, you stop looking. should be just a little bit cautious about an anecdote that ends with the camera being what is used to solve the crime, because if they have their own camera means, for example, at that point they can stop asking for other private cameras that may have recorded the same footage, using other methods to get the data they've gotten from the camera. So I'd be cautious about the counterfactual, even in the cases where plausibly the camera is the unique kind of factor that makes the crime solvable. Again, if you spend money on more foot patrols, more cops on the beats, some of those cops will solve crimes. Looking kind of retrospectively and saying, are there anecdotal instances of success, I think is a poor way to evaluate the effectiveness of a tool.
Well, that's the skeptic's answer, which doesn't actually address the question, which is, do you doubt that there are instances?
I do not doubt that there are instances in which there is utility to a camera. Okay.
That's a useful piece. So then, the main thrust of your argument, as I took it, was that this was an inefficient and unwise way to spend money. And just return to that in our discussion here. Where else would you invest the money? Take that same money. What else would you put it in?
Well, so we've mentioned several things. Actually, a lot of things that are done often in tandem with the cameras, and it's somewhat hard to disentangle what the component of the benefit is when benefits are found. But better street lighting, more cops on the beat, the gunshot detection systems that Dan mentioned, better engagement with private operators of camera. You can imagine maybe tax incentives to the extent there's a public good aspect to the private operation of cameras to encourage that. There's a whole universe of initiatives that are floated as crime reduction measures, many of which are effective. We ended up debating the ones, again, that sort of are creepy and invasive because they're controversial. So they get, I think, disproportionate attention relative to sort of more boring. I mean, it's effectively like TSA screening versus reinforced cockpit doors, right? The thing, besides the success of the initial attack, that I think most guarantees that we will never see another 9/11 is the relatively inexpensive and kind of privacy, utterly neutral reinforcement cockpit doors. The thing we end up focusing on is the much more visible and intrusive, pat downs and naked scanning machines. When they're sexy, but not necessarily the most effective measure, because in a sense, the most effective thing is kind of boring and uncontroversial.
Well, you certainly won't get me to defend the naked machine, so I'm not going to say that. But what you've posited is an empirical question, right? Which is the most effective expenditure of funds? Daniel cited a study, and I accept it at face value, that for every dollar spent on cameras, the city saved roughly $3. I have two questions for you. One, do you have reason to doubt that kind of econometric study? And second, with respect to the other opportunities that you've offered us, better lighting, et cetera, are there any studies you cite that would actually demonstrate that those are, in fact, better and more effective investments of resources?
So I'm going to agree. I think that is a good research program, in effect, and what we at least want to engage in before implementing systems that we know are high cost and that only occasionally have benefit. I won't say that let's say for example the urban study, which is again as far as I'm aware the most positive one about the effect of these two wide networks. It's not that I doubt that particular study as such, but rather that if you look at a range of studies that have been done in different cities, what you see is results ranging from some positive benefit to no real discernible benefit at all. And so given the sort of high inconstancy and the low level of, I think, confidence we can have in the results we're seeing in any particular city or the estimate of the relevant benefit there, that it just seems premature to seize on the handful of positive results as establishing that this is a model for other cities. Certainly, especially, I think, when the way this sort of rhetorically this is advanced is with a focus on terrorism in a way that I think is likely to skew the implementation in a way, sort of away from the thing that cameras actually seem to be effective at, which is, you know, locations like public transit and parking lots and that sort of thing, which is not where you're going to focus your efforts if what you're really thinking is that you're going to use these as a terror prevention tool.
I have one last question, but I want to do the last question, so tell me when my last question
is. This is it.
Oh, no, I had two more. Okay. So I will stop with this last question, and just so maybe an interesting point of agreement. So you've said it now twice, so I'm assuming from what I hear from you that you have no objection at all, theoretically, to the government use of public surveillance cameras in public structures.
Yeah. Right. Again, we're talking about places where the government is effectively the property owner, where any private property owner would have their own camera in that location, and you know, the government is the only one that can do it. Yeah.
I'll ask Jay, is that your view too in the ACU?
We don't have a problem with spot cameras in particular places where they, you know, there is good reason to think that they will provide a real concrete benefit.
So schools.
Well, maybe in certain spots in school, we don't want pervasive surveillance in schools. I mean, I think that
Julian, schools.
I think the same. Same as the case. I mean, where
public structures, public structures.
Meaning, I mean, like
the parking lot.
Sure.
Okay. Government building.
Yeah, we're not defending the no cameras ever anywhere position.
Okay.
In a situation where a similarly situated private owner would have a camera, I don't think it's.
Yeah, I will end with a rhetorical one, which is this actually reminds me of those wonderful maps about how you can't get across the city carrying a gun. Because of the 1,000 foot within a radius of a school or within a radius of a public building or another protected space. If you give away the public structures, you'll probably cover, I don't know, 60-70% of the city already, anywhere except the pure residential areas, which of course will again leave probably the poor who can't afford the private cameras on the wrong end of this stick.
Well,
I'll end there. Or on that, all that you
want. So one, you're talking about, you know, public structures, the courthouse. In a lot of cases, we're talking about cameras either inside or really kind of focused on the entryway. Put it this way: if that were the case, we wouldn't need to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on these pervasive citywide networks, because it would already, in a sense, be achieved through the surveillance cameras that are installed on public structures, just as a kind of localized security measure. The other point I'd make is that, again, even the most positive studies, and we do need to stress, if nothing else, the extent to which the urban study they're focusing so heavily on is really the most positive in a whole big universe of studies that shouldn't be considered sort of the unique and final word. But one of the points they do make is that the places where cameras are effective or seem to be effective when publicly operated, it is the downtowns, not really residential areas, are exactly the same places where you would expect to have the most non-networked private commercial cameras. And so the places where you are not likely to get those cameras, this is the class disparity he's worried about, are also the places where the public cameras seem to be a lot less effective.
This was the point in the program where I was going to ask some probing questions, but I want to leave plenty of time for you all. So I'm going to call for closing statements, brief closing statements from each side, but I'm hoping at some point in the closing statement somebody can address on both sides, or at least one of the sides, the whole issue of accountability mechanisms. We've talked about audits. We've talked about the DC Council having a hearing. We've talked about the prospect of civil litigation. All those things may not give many people comfort, in part because audits, city councils, and civil litigation take a long time and don't always find the facts. So I'm hoping we can talk a little bit about accountability mechanisms, since we're in this space.
Yes, I'll start off. I want to bring back to the very first point that Jay made, which was the same point I made, which is that these cameras work. There hasn't been disagreement that cameras work in many of these cases. And then there was a little bit of sleight of hand on this side where they said, well, you know, there's some cases where it doesn't work. Okay, I mean, what's really interesting, I have a paper in the back there. They mentioned the Urban Institute study, which looked at a number of things, looked at D.C. as well, and they say it didn't work as well in D.C., but it worked really well in Baltimore and Chicago. But the reason it didn't work in D.C. is because they had put in, they had listened to some of the privacy advocates who said, put in all these controls so that we couldn't actually have an effective camera system. So when we talk about having, safeguards, we do want them, but we don't want them to, negate the utility of these systems. And so I think it's actually very clear when you look at the evidence that these camera systems can be implemented successfully. And so the goal of other cities should be to replicate the best practices that we've developed over the last 10 to 15 years so you can implement them continuously so that they are cost effective, so that the police forces become more efficient, so that they deter crime. The second point I want to make is that, overall people do say they want these cameras. And this has been going back for a number of years. In 2007, ABC Washington Post did a survey, and Americans 3-1 favored increased use of surveillance cameras. This was done again a couple of months ago. New York Times CBS News poll showed that 78% of Americans favored surveillance cameras. And the reason I think is very clear. People generally want surveillance cameras because they give them benefits. If your car is vandalized and you come out of a restaurant, you're going to really hope there was a camera there recording this. If you're falsely accused of a crime, you're going to wish there was a surveillance camera. Pretty much the only time you don't want a camera is if you're guilty of something. Third,
that was sticking the bear in the bear's cage and rattling it.
But I just want to get back to the last point about what we're really talking about here. Because, on this side, you brought up a couple of points about, kind of risk of, a chilling effect or other kinds of things. But we're really talking about, what's the impact on crime? What's the impact on people's lives? And I just want to end with, talking about the case of the D.C. sniper. Because, this was an event that was happening, the attacks were happening in public. And it took a long time to catch the people involved. And the question really was, why did it take so long? This was back in 2002. There weren't the cameras out there now that are there now. And the reason it took so long is because police spent most of their time looking for a white van. There was this mysterious white van, and there's a lot of white vans out there. And they had all these eyewitnesses that said they saw this white van. Well, it turns out eyewitnesses aren't that reliable. If they had better video surveillance, we might have actually caught John Allen Muhammad and Lee Boyd Malvo much sooner. And in fact, there was a gas station there that possibly could have been recording it, but of course the gas station had the camera pointing at the cash register, because that's what gas stations are interested in. They're not interested in looking at the public spaces. So in closing, my point is here, they work, people want them. Without them, there's a serious impact on crime. So I think the case for surveillance cameras is clear, and I think it's really irresponsible not to take advantage of the technology that's available to us.
Okay. Our founding fathers created a system with limits on government power. They saw fit to impose inefficiencies on police and government power in order to strike the right balance between order and freedom. What we aim for in this country is ordered liberty, where we both have order and freedom, and sometimes we have to strike the right balance there. The Fourth Amendment and other parts of the Constitution expressed, and the founders in general expressed the view that the government should not be looking over all of our shoulders, literally or figuratively, unless it has specific individualized suspicion that we are involved in wrongdoing. It should not record everything that all of us do in case we later turn out to be a wrongdoer. That is why we don't allow the government to carry out searches without a warrant, listen to our phone calls without a warrant, etc. When you say that, and I guess that a concern that all the focus of your argument has been on the efficiency of law enforcement. Efficiency of law enforcement is definitely a social good, but it has to be balanced against the deeper values of our civilization, of freedom, of not being subject to overweening government surveillance. You say that cameras work. That statement is too simplistic. They work in some situations, they don't work in others. The studies, again, bears repeating. I mean, of six studies done in the U.S., the Urban Institute is pretty much the only one that found a significant benefit. There was one other one that did find some benefit in Orange, East Orange, New Jersey, but all the others found no benefit. Years-long
studies.
San Francisco.
Okay. I just want to ask.
The citrus study.
This one not finding out.
Okay.
We're not going to solve that. We don't need to get into the weeds of the studies. I mean, but I think that overall it's surprising that there's been such a weak finding for effectiveness. Clearly, they work for some things and they don't work for other things. But clearly, there's more to the debate than simply police efficiency. It's important that we stand by our values. Cameras in isolation are much different than cameras that are A, networked, and that are B, run by the government. And finally, this idea that if you have nothing to hide, you don't need to worry. That if you are not a criminal, then you don't need to worry about cameras. You may not want the fact that you are on the way to see an abortionist or an Alzheimer's doctor or a cancer doctor or a lover or a friend or a mistress or you're going to a gay bar and you're in the closet. There are many things that are not illegal that people nonetheless do not want recorded and shared. When people know these things about you, it gives them power over you. And so I think that these are deeper values of our society that we need to keep in mind as we balance the practical considerations involved in cameras here. And I guess I just want to make one more point, which is sometimes you need to look at the people who are actually on the ground, and there was a thread about the Urban Institute study by Chicago police on a blog that was a discussion forum for Chicago cops, and the sentiment towards the study was uniformly negative among the police who were in that show. They were dismissive of it. They basically scoffed at the finding that cameras had any effect. These are the cops who are on the ground, who see what's going on. Just to pull one quote, go to the people who live right by those cameras and ask them, the people, if crime has gone down because of them. The overwhelming answer will be no. The censor who got the contract will tell the masses that it deters crime, and so will the political entity get the kickbacks. The people who have the cameras there, it's cheaper to provide a false sense of security, i.e. a camera, than a human being. So the people on the ground are that's another voice I wanted to bring into the conversation that's not been part of the conversation, Urban Institute experts or whatever, but the cops on the ground in Chicago, at least, were pretty uniformly of the view that it was not positive. But, so there's my somewhat last-minute, thrown-together conclusion. Thank you.
Great. We have time for 2-3 questions. If you want to identify yourself and ask the question, thanks.
Hugh Grindstaff. How many of the panel have been a victim of a violent crime? Was it on camera?
No, I think there was a, as I recall, there was the Elks Lodge nearby may have had a camera, but it didn't catch the...
I was mugged right next to the Supreme Court 30 years ago. They didn't have a camera. But this morning, I got up and I walked to the Metro, past the Rockville Courthouse, camera. I used my Metro card to get on the Metro. Digital acknowledgement that I was there. I walked up on the platform, camera. I got off at Farragut North. I walked over to CSIS, camera. I walked out of CSIS, I went to Abampan, credit card. I walked out of Abampan
and
camera. I got on the Metro bus, camera. I walked this block and a half. I came in here. I came in downstairs, camera. I walked in here, camera. And unless you're using cash, people are going to know where you are. So once you submit yourself to the societal needs of using cash, going someplace, you're accepting the fact that you're going to be surveyed.
I want to suggest that we tend to think about privacy exclusively in terms of this kind of binary between what is exposed and what is secret. You know, this is out in public, therefore there's no privacy. This is what you do in your bedroom, therefore it's entirely private. And I think that is a mistake. I think that in some, whether you want to call it privacy or something else, there is a practical dimension of our privacy that is a function not of exposure or simpliciter, but of the aggregability and searchability of the data about us. So, for example, you go to the CVS and you buy a package of condoms. Later that evening, you go and have dinner with a date at a restaurant. Both of these things happen in public, are observed by many other people, but it is probably important to your level of comfort about these two public incidents that you do not think any one person, as opposed to anyone, is aggregating those data points, that the combination of them in a centralized way by a single entity makes all the difference. It's the difference between going around in public and being seen again by someone everywhere and being followed by someone everywhere. People feel very differently about that with good reason.
I will just add quickly that I have been the victim of a property crime and I had bicycles stolen from in front of the Metro in Clarendon. And there are cameras pointing in that direction on, from a DHS building that's nearby. Good luck in getting like anybody to like help me use that video to solve my crime, right? It didn't do me any good. It's all about, you know, so the question is, to whose benefit are these cameras being operated? And that is a detailed question, but I think that the incentives are all to increase the power of government and not necessarily to increase the power of individuals.
We'll let the other people ask questions.
Gentleman back there, then you, sorry.
Bob Gelman, I'm a privacy consultant. If there's a point of commonality here, I think that it has to do with an agreement that accountability measures are important for cameras. And I think possibly there would be agreement on at the highest level of generality about limits on how long you keep data and limits on use, and we would get into details and probably fight about those. And the question I have is, do you think that there's a need, since there's so many different camera operators, that there's a need for common standards for this that may be different in some cases, like for private cameras or public cameras, but that there ought to be rules that apply to everybody, including the privately owned cameras that we talked about?
Good question.
I'll take a swing at that one, because it's actually, I made that exact suggestion to the IACP, the International Association of Chiefs of Police, that there ought to be, you know, a best practices, a common standard. They just did that for the police use of drones, which seems to me a much less salient issue because there are a lot fewer of those around right now. I mean, there may be more coming in the future, and this is not a drone discussion here, but they went ahead and did that on something that is a relatively out there technology, and they don't, to my knowledge, have a kind of common set of standards, practices, you know, fill in the blank, keep for blank number of days, and then, you know, DC can do 30 and Chicago can do 60 if they want to. And I think that that's an extremely useful suggestion. It is exactly, from my perspective, the sort of thing that I would want. It would include prohibitions, you know, do not use cameras for surveillance of First Amendment protected speech. It would include some categorical issues, do not use surveillance in these, do not put cameras in these types of places, maybe, near churches, mosques. I could see rules like that. I'm not sure I know exactly what those rules would be, but I think it would be an excellent project.
So, right, I think it would be probably impractical. I mean, certainly if you're talking about the kind of camera that you can buy for $100 and stick in your window because you want to try and deter crime in your neighborhood, I think it's probably impractical to try and impose rules on anyone who installs a camera in their window in their home. Certainly the extent that I think we all agree that there will be some government-operated cameras, if nothing else, on subway platforms and in public buildings, you want rules that limit the retention and use. But the issue I have whenever people say, well, just impose safeguards, is that architectures are permanent and rules last as long as you are inclined to follow them. And so once the architecture is built, it is not revocable except at substantial cost. Rules can be ignored or superseded far more easily.
Can I just respond to that? I mean, because this is the second time you said it, and I kind of let it pass the first time because it's not a debatable proposition, but it strikes me as so utterly implausible that the United States, with its panoply of laws, inspectors general,
rules, regulations, privacy advocates like Bob, is going to sink into a system where the architecture is going to be, any architecture of security we put in place, whether it's cameras or drones or anything you want, is going to be so wildly misused that we will sink into Stasi land.
But how will we find out it's being wildly misused?
You. That's your job. Yes, absolutely. In the 40 years since COINTELPRO, when we had a fundamental change in the nature of your job, right? You know, Watergate changed the nature of your job. Watergate, you know, name me one large-scale scandal that has not been exposed. I mean, obviously, you don't know what...
Say, trying to make sure that I don't
know. There's a guy in a booth just like a
but there are so many of these instances that have been that the I mean if your plausible argument is that there's some secret architecture out there that we're unaware of today that is or is likely to actually take this data and pervasively misuse it for governmental purposes, and that we don't have structures in place that are powerfully likely to expose it and its malevolence, then I'm not in a position to argue against that, except to say that that's a remarkably dim view of the success of the American enterprise.
And we're not really talking about the federal government here. We're really talking about cities and municipalities. And I think you will see, for example, there was a report put out a couple months ago called Mapping Muslims, Muslim groups in New York City, talking about the effect on Muslim communities there of the pervasive surveillance, some of which involved cameras, some of which did not, and the chilling effects that had on that community. And in a sense, because I think Muslims are often sort of seen as at some remove from the mainstream American society, maybe this is not something that the rest of us were not in that community, attended to as a risk to us. But I found it really kind of heartbreaking reading, for example, that the Columbia University, the student Muslim group, had a meeting room where they had posted a sign saying, "We don't know who comes to these meetings. Please don't discuss anything politically controversial. We don't want trouble." I just found that dismaying and heartbreaking. And very often, things like this are exposed, proved not to be very useful, but years after the fact, when the harm is done.
Which is another way of saying there's a lot of space between what our ideal is and some sort of fascist takeover of America, for America to become a much more chilled and monitored and an ugly place. I think that's part of what the debate is.
I agree, but that's not the argument Julian's making. The argument Julian's making is that the architectures are themselves fundamentally so susceptible to abuse that they shouldn't be put into place, right?
We need to take a couple more questions. You, sir, and you
two. Yeah, just... Tim Edgar with Brown University now.
Good for you.
So two questions. One is, it seems to me that private cameras and the aggregation of data from private cameras, both businesses and individuals, is at least, if not more important than the issue of cameras operated by public authorities. And I was wondering if anyone has thought about the ways in which that could have some oversight mechanisms or some controls. It seems if you don't address that, you've got you may be missing the boat a little bit in terms of focusing just on the public cameras. And then the second point is we may be we are facing serious cyber insecurity. So what about the dangers really to both private and public cameras? But having a network surveillance architecture may be dangerous, not just because it could be abused by the United States. It could be abused by anyone who can hack into that system. And that is not just the United States. That could be foreign governments. That could be criminal organizations. Has there been any attention paid to the dangers of the insecurity of that network surveillance system? We've learned from yesterday's paper in the Washington Post that the Chinese were pretty effective in hacking into Google systems in order to figure out what, at least that's the report from Ellen Nakashima's article, do we, to determine who who the FBI was trying to surveil, who might be suspected of espionage, there are foreign powers that could potentially exploit this system, it seems to me, and I wonder if we have any thoughts about that.
I'll just answer the first of those. The second of those is a great question and requires more answer. I was at a cyber thing in Las Vegas, a DEF CON thing, and the question was, who do you fear more, the U.S. government or Google, in their data aggregation? And the uniform view amongst the cyber folks there was Google, because they're much more effective at this at this data aggregation than is the government. So your point about especially things like Memodo, which is the little camera I was talking about, which is going to automatically take a picture every 30 seconds, cloud storage, perfectly capable of data analytics and all the stuff. So, I would put that one up on my freak out list, too.
You're talking about Google Glasses and sort of personal video recordings. I think that...
On the cloud.
Yeah, well, in any case...
The ability to crowdsource video, whether it's taken by a business or an individual or anyone else, that kind of would allow you to evade the controls that you might put on a public...
I guess I have a couple points to make about that. Number one, I don't think it's inevitable that everybody's going to be wearing personal video recorders. I think etiquette will have a lot to say about that. When you sit down with a friend to have an intimate conversation you haven't seen in a long time, you're going to tell them to turn their damn camera off, right? And there's already been a little bit of a backlash against Google Glass. It's not clear that it's going to take hold. It might end up being like the Segway, right? It ends up with a niche.
I like that.
It ends up with a niche, but it doesn't become something that everybody does. So, and I think that etiquette is probably the proper mechanism to govern those kind of personal. The ACLU actually defends the constitutional right to take photography, the individuals to take photography in public places.
We are all already carrying very small networked cameras, and the reason I don't just walk around taping everyone is that it's really creepy. It's not that there's like a technological barrier to my doing it.
The iPhone commercial says now more pictures are taken.
This is just picking up on a few different strands because it seems like we left off on a topic that's actually known as surveillance, which is citizen surveillance from the bottom up as a kind of countervailing mechanism to fight the kind of abuses in the system, maybe the architecture that's in place where we have the abuse of power by, say, police, or I can't see it as effectively infiltrating things like carnivore and wiretapping. I guess surveillance is a sprawling topic, but why do you think there's so much focus on CCTV? We obviously see network analysis in the form of credit card storage, things online. We willingly relinquish a lot of that to Facebook and social media platforms. And the government, of course, wiretaps, we get phone lines, we get things of that nature. Do you think it's because it's in broad daylight, or it's just something that it's our last vestige, something we're trying to salvage as part of our civil liberties because of this kind of huge burgeoning government?
I guess two quick points. Number one, video is very concrete. People see video on CSI, they see it on the network news, whereas something like data mining is very abstract. Number two, we don't like a lot of those other things either in terms of our privacy. Those are our privacy problems. We try and solve them, but we. And number three, I think that a lot of the surveillance that is taking place in other areas, I think that to paraphrase Martin Luther King, the arc of surveillance is long, but it bends against liberty. In other words, it takes we put up cameras, you walk through your day, there are all these cameras, but you don't really think about them, they don't really affect your life, they don't have negative consequences, so you don't really care. But I think over time, the fact that our public spaces have changed, that people will sometimes end up on the evening news picking their nose because they're in public or whatever, because something happened next to them, or the cameras, the abuses do take place. And we're very social animals. We're hardwired to be conscious of who is watching us and who is not at all times. And as the feeling that we're not being watched gradually is replaced by the awareness that we are in fact being watched, that will have effects. And again, it will be a gradual process. But that's what a lot of our concern is.
Deer are just not neurologically wired to freeze when someone sells their Clickstream records to Axie. They are hardwired to freeze in headlights that look like eyes, just that we have an evolutionary heritage of, gaze detection modules in our brains that just very viscerally reacts to the experience of physical observation by eyes in a way that they don't naturally respond to other kinds of surveillance.
I just want to say that it's...
Are you opposed to surveillance culture?
Let me just say to the first part of your question, I mean, I think some of the opposition, which is, as I said, small when you look at the numbers, I think it's reactionary, and it's, I think, kind of, some people don't understand the technology. So, I mean, we were over here before that, why don't we use better lighting? You know, better lighting is an invasion of privacy if you expected, you know, to be out in the dark and no one seeing you. So, you know, where's the difference there? When we talk about chilling effects, you know, that there's this kind of sociological impact of having constant surveillance. You know, there's also a sociological impact of, you know, any technology. But in this case, there's also an impact of people walking around feeling safe. And so I think, you know, we're talking about, you know, different sides of this, but overall, I think it's just people getting used to the technology over time. We're used to lights. We'll be used to cameras.
Thank you so much. Big round of applause.
Oh, great.
This is how they used.